dozens killed in a Gaza airstrike.
We are seeing a humanitarian catastrophe on a scale that it's very hard to believe unless you see it, with many children, but also people of all ages, injured, killed, disabled for life.
Plus D-Day, 80 years ago today.
On behalf of the American people, as Commander-in-Chief, it's the highest honor to be able to salute you here in Normandy once more.
And later, a look at the mental health struggles of Israeli and Palestinian children. And a new report on climate change has some worrying news. Today is Thursday, June 6th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel hit a Gaza UN-operated school on Thursday with what it described as a targeted airstrike on up to 30 Hamas fighters inside, while a Hamas official said 40 people, including women and children sheltering in the school, were killed. Abu Zuri Abu Dar was there. He said he saw the rocket falling, and he saw corpses on the second floor of the building. Joseph Simpson is a doctor and spokesperson for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. He says the hospital and its staff is overwhelmed.
We are seeing a humanitarian catastrophe on a scale that it's very hard to believe unless you see it, with many children, but also people of all ages, injured, killed, disabled for life. This hospital, all the staff are doing an amazing job, but it's so difficult to care for this number of patients. We can't. The Palestinian staff have been working since the beginning of the war without a break. It is very hard to provide the amount of care. There is not enough aid. There are not enough staff. There is not enough space.
Israeli authorities maintain the strike was targeting terrorists in specific rooms of the school. David Mentzer is an Israeli government spokesperson.
Three rooms in the school, in the building, were used by Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists. We assessed that 20 to 30 terrorists were in the compound at the time of the strike. We targeted with precision strikes on the specific classrooms, What we know, of course, we know that the terrorists were, what they were doing inside a UN school, they were hiding. The compound was used for staging attacks and as a forward operating base.
When pressed on the high number of civilian casualties claimed by the Hamas-run health ministry, Mentzer shot back.
Needless to say, Hamas health ministry are habitual liars. They habitually overinflate figures. I've laid out in some detail all of the steps that Israel took to prevent any harm to civilians. These were targeted strikes in three individual rooms in this United Nations school. We are investigating the issue and will come out with the results of our investigation very, very shortly.
The strike took place at a sensitive moment in negotiations on a ceasefire agreement entailing the release of hostages seized by Hamas on October 7th and some of the Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Hamas seeks a permanent end to the war. Israel says it must destroy the Islamist group first. Not surprisingly, many Israeli and Palestinian children are suffering from severe trauma because of the October 7th attack on Israel and the ensuing 8 months of war between Israel and Hamas. Therapists on both sides say the effects could be long-term for these most vulnerable members of society. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Erez and Sahar Calderon were among dozens of children whom Hamas kidnapped and took to Gaza on October 7th. They were released after 52 days in Hamas captivity, although their father is still a hostage. Their mother, Hadass, says her children still suffer from trauma 6 months after their release and worry terribly about their father.
My children can't sleep. They're terrified. Their father is coming.
My children can't sleep. They're terrified. Their father is coming in their dreams. He comes and says and screams, please don't forget me. They came back, but they're still there. They're still in the 7th of October. They live it every day. They never feel safe. They're afraid from strangers. They believe the terrorists will come again.
They believe the terrorists will come again.
Israeli trauma experts say they are struggling to contend with the unique traumatic experience of the Hamas invasion and the displacement of more than 200,000 people from their communities near Gaza and on the northern border. Thousands of psychotherapists have been recruited by both the Israeli government and volunteer organizations to treat the traumatized children and families. Asher Ben-Aryeh is a child trauma specialist at Hebrew University in Jerusalem.
We have, unfortunately, a lot of experience in shelling and in bombing and even in war victims, but we never experienced kidnapping of children. We never experienced the massacre of parents in front of their children. How do you explain to a child that he is safe now when he's seen his safest place, his bedroom, burned and his parents murdered in his house?
In Gaza, most of the 1 million Palestinian children have been traumatized by the widespread death and destruction caused by Israeli airstrikes and seeing their families killed and their homes destroyed. UN agencies estimate that more than 15,000 Palestinian children have been killed, 12,000 have been wounded, and about 19,000 orphaned during this war. Marwan Shaheen, a mother of six children living in the Nusayrat refugee camp, has been displaced four times since the war began. None of her children have been able to go to school, and her 18-year-old daughter suffers from schizophrenia but has not been able to get medicine or treatment. Shaheen says her two youngest children fear any noise and barely sleep. She says the war has destroyed them psychologically, personally, socially, health-wise, and nutrition-wise.
My 8-year-old daughter and my 9-year-old son haven't allowed me to sleep since the beginning of the war. Any sound scares them, even if it's the noise of a car, not shelling. And because they hardly sleep, they wake up very tired. The war destroyed them psychologically, personally, socially, health-wise, and nutrition-wise.
Because most of Gaza's hospitals and medical services have been destroyed, children's trauma cannot even begin to be treated until the war ends, Palestinian medical officials say. Preliminary research shows at least two-thirds of Gaza's 1 million children are suffering from trauma. Dr. Mohammed Iskafi of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society in the West Bank.
They are facing a lot of difficulties. They are suffering from signs and symptoms as a result of the continuous war and pressure on them, and the the loss of family members, the loss of houses, and so on.
Medical professionals and parents of both Israeli and Palestinian children worry that even when the war between Israel and Hamas finally ends, the emotional scars will take many years to heal. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Turning our attention now to Europe, Russian forces continue shelling territory across Ukraine. Meanwhile, President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Normandy, and he's expected at the G7 summit in Italy next week. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Before dawn on June 6, Russian forces attacked Ukraine with drones in the Mykolaiv, Kherson, Zaporizhia and Khmelnytskyi regions. As a result of the attack, an infrastructure facility in one of the settlements in the Khmelnytskyi region was hit and explosions were heard in Zaporizhia. No casualties were reported. In addition, Russian forces attacked the Dnipropetrovsk and Kherson regions with ballistic missiles and drones. In the Dnipropetrovsk region, an infrastructure facility, a 9-story building, and 3 private houses in Nikopol were damaged. Drone debris also hit a bus, injuring 4 people. 19 towns in the Kherson region and the city of Kherson were attacked. 3 residential buildings, a shopping mall, and private business facilities were heavily damaged. 3 people were reported injured. Meanwhile, President Zelensky visited Qatar to discuss further actions on returning Ukrainian children kidnapped by Russia in the occupied Ukrainian territories. During the meeting with His Highness the Emir of Qatar, Zelensky talked about continuing this work with the International Coalition for the Return of Ukrainian Children and within the Peace Summit, which is among the items on the agenda. Qatar has been actively involved in the preparation of the Peace Summit and is expected to become one of the Middle East's voices for the return of Ukrainian people home, global food, nuclear and energy security. The parties also discuss a number of bilateral economic and security issues. On Thursday, Volodymyr Zelensky with the First Lady Olena Zelenska arrived in France to participate in the events dedicated to the day of the Allied landings in Normandy during the Second World War. Zelensky is expected to meet with US President Joe Biden and French President Emmanuel Macron. Zelensky will also meet with the French defense minister. They will visit a factory near Paris where artillery ammunition is manufactured. Zelensky is also expected to give a speech in the lower house of the French parliament and hold talks with its leader, Yelbron Pivet, who visited Ukraine in March. After France, Zelensky will participate in the G7 summit in Italy next week. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
The Kakhovka Dam in southern Ukraine collapsed on June 6, 2023. Hundreds of square kilometers were flooded, damaging homes, infrastructure, and the environment. Ukraine blames Russian forces, which occupied the dam. However, Russia denies the accusation. A year later, the impact of the collapse is ongoing. Lysia Bakalets has the story.
Residents of Afanasyevka village near the southern Ukrainian city of Mykolaiv say they remember vividly last summer when the Kakhovka dam collapsed and their houses were flooded. The water rose to this level, says Afanasyevka resident Olena Guluk. She points to the line at shoulder level where the remaining wallpaper gives way to bare stone wall. The Kakhovka dam was destroyed in a blast last June. Russia had occupied the dam on the Dnipro River since the start of the war. After the explosion, water flowed downstream, flooding settlements like Afanasyevka. Guluk filmed that moment. The water rises before your eyes, she says. Fish swim in the garden. The smell is awful. There is nothing to breathe, she adds. Some houses were flooded to the roof for several days. The houses have absorbed a lot of water, so the walls are still wet. Afanasyevka resident Tatiana Fomina says volunteers brought her an industrial dehumidifier. She says she already poured out a bucket of water in the morning, and look, it's already half full. That is how much has collected here again, she adds. Orchids, some clothes and a chair, all that survived from Tatiana's household. She says she renovated the house just before the war. Tatiana Fomina admits she sometimes just sits on the chair and cries. It's so hard to lose everything, she says. She sits and thinks about what she can do next. Apart from the destruction, the village also has a problem with drinking water. After the flooding, the water in the river and residents' wells is polluted. Afanasyevka village head Vasily Homko says the water carried everything, reeds, debris, garbage. Somewhere a gas station was affected and an oil stain came to the village. One house was completely covered in oil, he says. Volunteers have delivered clean water to the village for a year, but only for drinking and cooking. Locals still use the polluted water for bathing and other uses. Homko inspects the level of drinking water in the barrels. He says one is empty, another still has water for one day. He will call tomorrow and ask volunteers to bring more. Many other villages are in the same situation. The Kakhovka dam collapse flooded more than 600 square kilometers, according to the Ukrainian Ministry of Environment. Yulia Marhель leads the eco-movement Let's Do It Ukraine. She says part of the affected territories is occupied. They cannot study them. Water samples from Ukraine-controlled territories still contain toxic substances and heavy metals, she adds. Also, at least 500,000 hectares of farmland were left without irrigation, the agriculture minister said. And energy production was affected because the dam was a part of hydroelectric power plant. Alexander Harchenko, director of the Energy Industry Research Center in Kyiv, says that before the war, Ukraine could survive without one hydropower plant. Now that Russian attacks have destroyed Ukraine's generating capacity elsewhere and the country is left practically without thermal generation, it is a significant loss, he adds. Ukrainian officials say the flooding killed more than 30 people in the Ukrainian-controlled territories. In Afanasyevka, everybody survived. Locals say that's the biggest blessing they could dream of. Lesya Bakalets, VOA News.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. On Wednesday, the EU Global Climate Change Service reported that last month was the hottest May ever. It marked the 12th straight monthly record high. Experts say it's going to get worse. VOA's Laurie London spoke with EU Climate Change Service Director Carlo Bontempo.
Over the last few years, the Copernicus Climate Change Service of the European Commission has been monitoring the climate and providing update every month. And the last 12 months have been rather unusual because they have been, each one of them at their moment in time, has been the warmest month we have ever recorded. So our data set goes back to 1940, actually January 1940, and every single month of the last 12 months have been warmer than any previous month in this record. From what we know, this is also very likely to be the warmest 12-month period in a much longer data set, spanning probably thousands, if not tens of thousands of years. And on top of this element, so this is not the only time that we have a long streak of record-breaking month. It happened before in 2015 and 16, which was also an El Niño record. But it's the first time that 11 of these 12 months are above 1.5 degrees with respect to pre-industrial. So since July last year, July 2023, every single month, including May, has been above 1.5. And this is the warmest 12-month period ever recorded in our data set.
Is this as something that was predicted, or is it happening faster than previously predicted?
In a sense, to some extent, both things are true. Because if you look at what the climate model told us some 20 years ago about the kind of temperature we were likely to experience in the 2020s, well, we were not too far off from the temperature we're seeing now. So I would argue that the climate information, the climate data, the climate model provided useful guidance that maybe we didn't listen enough to. That said, there were surprises in 23. There are things we have not fully understood. The speed of some of the changes was higher than expected, and this calls for more research. So we don't understand everything, but I would argue we understand a significant part of what we see. And maybe as a society, we haven't yet taken full advantage of this knowledge, this data, and this insight that climate science provides.
We've been seeing some really devastating weather events pretty much all across the globe. What can we expect to come?
These streaks of record-breaking months at some point will stop. We won't continue breaking records forever. But this, it would probably be momentarily. It will happen only momentarily because there is a tendency towards a warmer climate. So maybe next month or in 2 months or maybe in 6 months, we will have a month that is not record-breaking. And this will tell very little about the bigger picture. We are going towards warmer temperature and it's basically certain that the average temperature of the next 5 years or 10 years will be higher than the average temperature of the last 5 years or last 10 years. So we are already in basically uncharted territory. We are going towards warmer temperature, and it's enough to read what the IPCC told us a few years back about what to expect. So we do expect intense precipitation to become more intense, and this is already seen in the observation, so you don't need a climate model to see that. We do expect drought to become more widespread, heat wave to we have seen just in the last few days the heat waves affecting India, affecting part of the Middle East and Africa. These heat waves will become more frequent. frequent, more last longer, and more intense. So these are some of these of the example of what we have to expect. And on the time scale of the next few years, we don't have much control. So the temperature will go up, will continue to go up. And in a sense, the record-breaking temperature we've just lived through will be remembered in all likelihood, at least in the near future, as cold temperature, because temperature will keep going up. That said, if we put our act together and we reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases and we stabilize the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we still do have a chance of coming back to this cold temperature by the end of the century.
Obviously, we're seeing, as we mentioned, devastating weather events with flooding and mudslides and heat waves and drought. Yeah. And should we be expecting more of the same?
We are not yet on a steady state. It's not a new normal. Things are still warming up. We're still in a transient. So things will get worse in terms of temperature. There is very little doubt about it. So in a sense, for me, the element of reflection is the fact that we are not blind in front of these changes. We do have useful data. We do have useful insight, useful information. And especially on the data. Data, for me, is what's happening, is a reflection of reality. And it shouldn't be an element of ideological debate or discussion. It's just where we are. We have to be realistic and react to the fact we have. So that's, for me, my appeal, if you want. Let's look at the data. Let's look at the observation. Let's look at the information we have. And let's discuss on what is the best way of reacting to the current setup.
Lori London is host of Issues in the News here on VOA. She was speaking with Carlo Buontempo of the EU Global Climate Change Service. And finally today, a somber anniversary in Normandy, France. It was 80 years ago, June 6, 1944, when over 150,000 Allied troops stormed the beach in the effort to liberate Europe from the Nazis. Though they didn't know it at the time, the Allied invasion of France marked the beginning of the end of World War II. Celebrating Allied unity, President Joe Biden made an impassioned call for the defense of freedom and democracy, urging Western powers to stay the course like they did in 1944, and to help Ukraine not surrender to Russian tyranny.
The Allied forces of D-Day did their duty. Now the question for us is, in our hour of trial, will we do ours? We're living in a time when democracy is more at risk across the world than any point since the end of World War II, since these beaches were stormed in 1944. Now we have to ask ourselves, will we stand against tyranny, against evil, against crushing brutality of the iron fist? Will we stand for freedom? Will we defend democracy? Will we stand together? My answer is yes, and only can be yes.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was there. He, too, drew the parallels between liberating France from the Nazis and liberating his own country from the Russians.
You're here for the Normandy landing. Do you expect one day a Ukraine landing?
I hope so.
Mostly, however, the day was about the veterans of the invasion, the men who ran ashore from boats while being shot at or who parachuted into enemy territory. Many World War II veterans are over 100 years old. All are elderly. Their numbers are dwindling. President Biden said it was the highest honor to salute the veterans who had assembled there.
On behalf of the American people, and as Commander-in-Chief, it's the highest honor to be able to salute you here in Normandy once more. All of you, God love you.
The day was also a moving tribute to the more than 4,400 Allied troops killed during the invasion. President and Mrs. Biden laid wreaths in the cemetery, marking the graves of the young men buried so far from home. And that's going to wrap it up for today. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.